I ain't got no home, I'm just a roaming round. Just a wandering worker, I go from town to town. And the police make it hard wherever I may go. And I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories. And you're hearing Woody Guthrie's I Ain't Got No Home in This World Anymore. That was his very first commercial recording and was on his most successful album, Dust Bowl Ballads. It was also considered one of the first concept albums. But we played this song because it speaks about the experience of families just like that of our next guest, B. Wayne Hughes Jr. And he's joining us for our On Leadership series, where we talk with leaders of all stripes about what shaped their lives, what they've learned as a leader, and where they're going today, what they're leading. So far, we've talked to Faye Vincent, former head of Columbia Pictures and Major League Baseball commissioner. Brad Anderson, the former CEO and the man of Best Buy and the man who built that company. And Deanne Turner, who runs all of the talent for Chick-fil-A. And also, we regularly talk to Pat Williams about leadership. We've done a Bear Bryant hour, a John Wooden hour, a Martin Luther King hour. We just did an hour on the leadership qualities of Abraham Lincoln. And Wayne, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Lee.
You bet. Oh, look, we love starting at the beginning. And you were VP of acquisitions at your family's enterprise, Public Storage. And that's the largest publicly traded storage company in the U.S. And you presently run a real estate management company you founded named American Commercial Equities. And you're also a billionaire, something your father, the founder of Public Storage, actually asked Forbes to remove, to take him off that list. And that's where I'd like to start our time together, Wayne. We talk a lot about fathers and sons on this show and the impact of fathers. Tell us your father's story and what he's meant in your life.
That's a long story. I think that the first thing I would say about my dad is that he's one of a kind. I don't know anybody like him. And that growing up as his son was a challenge, but it was also a great educational experience. My dad came out from Oklahoma during the Dust Bowl and came to Southern California in the mid-30s and is an American he's an American success story. Worked for the Herald Express, which was William Randolph Hearst's paper. He sold more subscriptions to the paper than anybody in the United States, which got him a college scholarship to USC. He was the first guy in my family to go to college. Little funny story about that. I was at a cattle auction years ago, and I was sitting next to the Hearst family, and we were bidding against each other on cows. And I thought, only in America, within one generation, can the son of the paper boy be out there bidding against cows with the family that owned the paper.
That is so true, Wayne. And by the way, we just did an hour on Merle Haggard. And obviously, Merle had the sort of same pilgrimage that your family did, left because of the crisis in the Midwest and in Oklahoma, and ended up in that part of California known as Bakersfield, the oil patch.
He was in Bakersfield. Merle Haggard's father, I think it's his father, married my mother's sister. both of their second marriage, or maybe it was his third marriage. And so as kids, my dad and Merle Haggard knew each other.
Well, that's amazing. And actually, Wayne, we are going to start doing a 6 degrees of separation segment because this happens so often in life that these connections occur. But so your dad does these things. What was the real acumen? Was it his perseverance? Was it his discipline? Was it his sales process? What were some of the core principles you learned from your dad? Because I think that's what dads can teach sons in the end, principles.
Yeah, well, I think beyond teaching me how to be a man, a couple of things come to mind. One is you're good for your word, and if you are wanting to go somewhere, the The word you don't use is go. It's let's go. And so don't be thinking that folks are going to be following you anywhere unless you're going there yourself. He was always been a great worker, and when we were growing up, we didn't have a whole lot. Public storage did not really explode until the end of the 1970s, and so I was already in college when it really sort of hit its stride. When I was a kid, my dad took a job at Sears because he had a budget that he did not want to blow, and Christmas was coming up, and so he just took the extra job so that we could have the presents for Christmas. I grew up in the San Gabriel Valley. We started in El Monte and moved to Rosemead and then to Temple City and then later on to San Marino. And if you know anything about Southern California, that's right up the economic ladder.
You bet. You bet. And it's interesting that your dad's fiscal prudence is something that I find so many young people today don't have. And so many people in my generation, Wayne, they'll charge it and then figure out how to pay it later. And what a lesson to learn as a young man watching your dad do that.
Well, I think when he grew up, there wasn't the belt and suspenders that the government is offering now. I mean, there was the WPA, but the bottom line was is that if you weren't working, you weren't eating. And during World War II, it was not uncommon for my dad's family and other families that were in the San Gabriel Valley to go to the Central Valley and pick cotton for the weekend.
Yep. Yep. And this is Lee Habib. You're listening to B. Wayne Hughes Jr., and we're doing an On Leadership series for the next 26 weeks. We're going to close out the year one a week, and we love looking at leaders across the spectrum, from sports to business to faith. Heck, sometimes just a really amazing mom who makes a difference in a community. More with Wayne after these messages.
But I knew that it would come. Someone. And I thought of all the bad luck and the struggles we went through and how I lost you and you lost you.
I may not always love you, but long as there are stars above you, you never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd be without you.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we're talking to B. Wayne Hughes Jr., and this is our On Leadership series. And again, we love to talk to leaders from every walk of life. And Wayne's story, his family's story, is extraordinary. And by the way, tune in to our Sam Walton Hour. We did it last week in celebration of his life. What a beginning, middle, and end to that story, folks. And that's on our website at OurAmericanNetwork.org. And Wayne, we heard a singer I think you know bumping in there. We heard Don Henley, by the way, coming out. I know he's one of your favorites. Tell us about the young lady singing in that song that we just bumped in with.
I'm not familiar with the young lady you're referring to, unless you're referring to my daughter.
Oh, her. Oh, that's right. Well, and is she passion? Wayne is she's looking.
Yeah, no, she my daughter Kylie Hughes is a singer-songwriter. She lives in Nashville and she's trying to make it in the world of music.
Well, that's fine.
Which is no easy deal.
It is no easy deal. My sister went down this road when she was 16 years old. She got a little lucky and wrote a hit song for a band called Cool and the Gang. And then the next thing you know, she got a taste for being a professional songwriter. And she's now living in L.A. and doing the same thing. It is one tough life, Wayne. There are ups, there are downs. But my dad did the one thing a dad could do. Tell her to work hard and pursue her dream. And she's been able to make a living doing it. So God bless you for...
Well, you know, there's musicians and there's performers and there's songwriters. If you have to choose one, choose being the songwriter, okay? Because you get paid for it.
That's exactly right. You know, we just had on an hour with Dave Cobb, and Dave Cobb is the hottest producer in Nashville, and he's doing Chris Stapleton's record and Jason Isbell's records, and these are all writers, and I think Cobb got the idea, hey, why don't we have some of these writers who write for Adele and all these other people just record their own music, and it's exploding,
right.
So you never know. But back to your story. Is there one story about your dad before we move on into your life that comes to mind that reveals the most about his nature and his mentorship in your life?
Not one that I hadn't already shared. I mean, I think that, you know, my dad was a constant presence. He was busy working all the time. He still works. He started a company, you know, after he was 80 years old, called American Homes for Rent, which was timing to go ahead and buy all of these houses that were being foreclosed all across the United States, and it was sort of a public storage part two, because he knew how to raise the money and he knew how to put together a management company, and at age 81 he put together American Homes for Rent. And I think that the company is publicly traded, and they own and operate 40,000 homes across the United States.
It's so much for retirement, huh?
I think retirement's overrated.
I think it is too. I've seen a lot of good men, by the way, go into retirement, get bored out of their minds, and actually lose a real sense of meaning in their life. Not that work is the be all and end all of life, but it does give us so much meaning. And I think if we're Christians, and I am, and I know you are, work is something that the Lord requires from us as well, Wayne. I wanted to talk about your first job, because we ask everybody about their first job. It's so revealing. What was yours?
You know, you said that I was the guy at acquisitions at public storage. I started out as the janitor. and I was fired. I did not do a very good job when it came to the bathrooms.
And that was it.
And the staff complained, and so they had to let me go. But I had weekend jobs where we were opening up storage facilities, and all of the spaces needed to be swept out. And so I would show up, and I'd get paid, $3.25 an hour, and I would sweep out 500 or 600 storage spaces from 5x5s to 10x20s, and it'd take me a couple days, and have a little bit of money in my pocket, and then I went to USC, was able to get a couple of summers in where I was able to travel and do things, and then one summer I came back from having a job in Hawaii, and my dad said, I think that I'm going to get you a real job, and the next thing I know, I was working in a slaughterhouse in downtown Los Angeles, owned by the Kardashian family, by the way, and I ended up working on the loading dock. My shift started at 2 in the morning and went till 10 in the morning. And that was probably the toughest job I'd had, and I knew right then and there that this was not sustainable for me. But it was a great experience. It's kind of interesting, because back then it was a union job, and of course I was sort of like in a gray area, because I was a student at USC, and so the union guy would come by and he'd give me a bad time about once a week. But I was making $18 an hour, like everybody else was. And, you know, that's a wage that you can send your kids to school on. Now that job doesn't exist anymore.
Yep.
Okay. You're working at a slaughterhouse, you're making, $9. And I don't know what happened. Okay. But, you know, jobs like that with the consolidation of the food industry and with any number of political things that happened along the way, that job disappeared.
Yeah, and I think also the mechanization of so much labor has changed the lives of many men who I think now on the margins, Wayne, and having a hard time being providers for their family, something we really are digging into in this show over the next few months. You know, we love to talk about...
Yeah, no, it lends itself into a discussion about globalization, yep. And what's necessarily might be good for the consumer is not necessarily good for the laborer or for the guy that's doing the work.
That's right, and
it's great that we can all go to Walmart and buy something for next to nothing. But the bottom line is that people need jobs, and they have kids and wives and mortgages and food bills, and they're not making it.
Yep. And I think that's why we're seeing the political unrest we are now on both sides of the political aisle. I think that hardworking Americans are feeling like the country's not working for them, and not much is working for them.
You can see it in the folks that are supporting Senator Sanders. Okay, all those young kids have never experienced a bull market. They don't have no idea that what capitalism is capable of doing, because we haven't had a bull market for goodness sakes, probably 12, 15 years.
That's right. Yeah, they don't know what a full labor market looks like either. And it's hard to know with more limited taxes and with unleashed regulations. And by the way, if we increase the earned income tax credit for people who may be being left behind, because the answer isn't always to make the government raise wages, but there are really interesting policy things on the table. But right now, it doesn't seem we can have a rational discussion about much of anything, Wayne, given the current political climate.
No, that's exactly right. We're in a very, very poisonous environment.
Yeah, and hopefully this too will pass. And after this, everybody spits out the bile. We can have a real discussion. And when we come back, Wayne, we want to talk about your faith. And then also we want to talk about one of your mentors and one of your heroes. One of mine, too. And that's Chuck Colson. And we're preparing an hour on his life as we speak. And it's quite something. But just real briefly, you came to faith, if you could, in about a minute here, and then we'll catch more on the back end. You came to your faith a little bit later in your life. Talk about that real briefly, and again, we'll catch up with more of it on the other side.
Well, I was losing my marriage, and unfortunately, I did lose my marriage 10 years later. But I realized that I'd been blessed with just about every good thing that can happen, and I wasn't doing a very good job of stewarding all the gifts that I'd been given. And basically it came down to the best that I could hope for was to be mediocre. And I didn't want to be mediocre. I didn't want to be a mediocre dad or a mediocre husband or a mediocre friend or a mediocre son. I wanted to go ahead and give my best, and I was having trouble. So I always knew that the Bible was truth. But I was unwilling to go ahead and live my life that way because I didn't want to be a hypocrite.
Yep.
So I sort of came to the end of my rope and realized that that I wasn't going to be a very good captain of my ship, so I turned my life over to Christ.
Well, I think quite a number of people understand that. That's my life, Wayne, at 43 years old. I figured that out, too. I still have my marriage. I hope I keep it. I'm working hard at it, and it's my number one priority besides God, and then work and everything else. This is Lee Habib. We're talking to Wayne Hughes, and this is our On Leadership series. We're going out with the Alabama Shakes, and we love playing the music that our guests love. More after this. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And you're listening to this song from the worship group Hillsong called Forever Rain. And by the way, on this show, we have no categories of music we prefer. You'll hear everything from Irving Berlin. We did a segment on Led Zeppelin and Robert Plant and his remarkable journey, particularly in Nashville in the later part of his life. And this is one of Greg Hengler's favorite groups. And it's the subject of a soon-to-be-released movie. Our guest, B. Wayne Hughes Jr., is the executive producer of, titled Hillsong, Let Hope Rise. Wayne, you decided to focus as you moved along into the space and your journey with Christ, your journey as, I think, as a man, because I think in the end, when we start to hit our 50s, we start to think about meaning. I think we start to think about, what are we here for? And it's sad that we as men don't get to this earlier. I'm not sure it's how we're hardwired, Wayne, but either way, some of us are late bloomers. What led you to this space of called prison reform? And talk about the role that Chuck Colson played in your life.
Well, it actually started out as a political journey after Obama got elected and was controlling both houses. I decided to get politically active and was going back to Washington, D.C., and I really got a first-class education as to how things are done in Washington, and it occurred to me that if you're not at the table, you're on the menu, and that really was for 99% of the population. I didn't like it very much, but I met Chuck Colson along the way, and I like to say that, you know, Chuck vaccinated me when I wasn't looking, because he probably, outside of my dad, is the one person that's made the biggest impact in my life. And Chuck basically told me something that I'll never forget. He said, politics is nothing but a reflection of culture. If you don't like the politics, look at the culture. If you want to make a difference, you're not going to make it in politics. You're going to make it fighting into the culture wars. And at that point, I was looking for significance in my life. I'd made the money. I was looking to go ahead and help my country. I mean, anybody can see that we're in a world of hurt, and things have only gotten worse since then. But I saw what Chuck was doing, and I realized that what I was looking for was not going to be found in the mirror. It was going to be focusing my gaze on the other. And I was invited to a fundraiser for Prison Fellowship, and in one evening, God changed my heart. My empathy quotient, which was not very large at the time, tripled all in one night. I saw what was possible with the programs that Chuck was putting into place. And I just never looked back. I said, okay, I'm in. And there is a program called the Urban Ministry Institute, which is a partnership between Prison Fellowship and World Impact. It's a 3.5-year seminary degree, not unlike what you would get at Fuller, minus the Greek and the Hebrew, that inmates were wanting to go ahead and participate in, but there was no money. And so I told Chuck that I would go ahead and support the program in California, only in California. I believe in management by walking around, and I also believe that writing a check, while it's wonderful, I wanted to be a part of it, because there's a blessing in it. And so we took the program that had 50 students 3.5 years ago. Today, if you count our alumni who paroled out, we have over 1,000 students. A big reason for jumping in the way that I did was as I was able to visit Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. In the 1970s, 60 Minutes had a program called The Bloodiest Prison in the United States, and it was about Angola. And I'm in high school, I'm watching, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. It was frightening. And so Chuck invited me to go to Angola and see what Warden Kane had done with a very similar a seminary program. And I walked through Angola unescorted with the warden, and saw basically the graduates of the seminary ran Angola, whether it was the metal shop or the auto shop or the honor farm. These guys were in charge, and the culture in Angola had changed from one of the worst prisons to one of the safest prisons. Prisoner-on-prisoner violence and prisoner-on-prison guard violence was a fraction of what it was when I watched the program 30 years previous. And I asked them what the number was, and they said it was, they gave me an X number, and I did it real quick. It was basically 3%. 3% of the men in Angola had graduated from the seminary. I said, well, that's possible in Angola. It's possible anywhere. And so we jumped in with both feet. In California, we went from 50 students. We funded, $4,000 to go ahead and fund a student for 3.5 years. And we funded for 150. Within 9 months, we had 600 students. And so it was like it just exploded. And we went from 2 prisons to 30 prisons here in California. We have been accepted into Pelican Bay, which is really the heart of darkness when it comes to prison violence and gang politics, and it has just been nothing short of a miracle.
You know, we spent a lot of time on this subject, Wayne, and we speak to a lot of guys who've gotten out of prison, former gang members, some who just were compelled to join a gang because to not be in a gang in some of these neighborhoods makes you ripe for, well, opportunity and crime itself. Many of these guys had no fathers.
Oh, yeah, no. When you go to prison, you have to join up.
Yep.
Okay, there are no Lone Rangers in prison. But if you are seeking a relationship with God as you know him, okay, and you're not faking it, because if you're faking it, you're really in trouble.
Yep.
But if you're not faking it, you get a pass.
Yep.
And a lot of men are looking for that second chance. Okay, I mean, even the worst of the worst. Well, I mean, obviously, there's going to be some that are going to be beyond beyond anybody else's reach, but God can reach them. And so, what's happened is that as the program has exploded, we went to our first graduation. We had 2 graduates out of Norco, and then just about a month ago, and maybe 50 of the general population came into the church to honor the graduates. A month ago, we had 6 graduates, and there was standing room only in the church at Norco. And so it's already having an effect. Now, before Toomey came along, men and women who were paroling out didn't know whether to turn right or left when they were leaving the prison. About 60% of our students are met by their families when they leave. So the healing's already taking place beyond the prison walls as a result of the affirmative steps that these men and women are taking.
Well, it's a beautiful thing. And, you know, one of the things we stumbled upon, even as we talked about Merle Haggard, he was 70 or so and he years old, and he was being interviewed by Dan Rather. And he talked about a few good souls in prison who saved him from another escape that would have kept him in jail for a really long time. He also talked about how hard it was to come out of prison. At the time, that it was the loneliest thing in the world,
right,
to leave prison and have a felony record. No one wanted to hire you. Your friends in the civilian world didn't trust you. And you sometimes wish you could just go back home to prison. So we spend a lot of time on this, Wayne. We're so honored and lucky that you are joining us today on our On Leadership segment. And when we come back, we're going to talk to a few folks who are leaders in this space. And mentorship is a big part of your world, and it's a big part of ours. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More with On Leadership and B. Wayne Hughes Jr. after these messages.
Me to die, but they wanted me to live, and I know why. So I do life in prison for the wrongs I've done, but I pray every night for death.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling down the.
This is Lee Habib, and this is our On Leadership series. This is our final segment with B. Wayne Hughes Jr., and someone who knows a lot about building businesses, making money, but in the end, the path to meaning, the path to significance, the path that God put him on was to work with, well, those who were on the fringes of society. Johnny Cash, by the way, I think we all loved him because of his concern for those that so many of people in this country aren't concerned about. Bono said about Johnny Cash when he died that Johnny didn't sing to the damned, he sang with the damned. And I think there before the grace of God go I. I think in these prisoners, there's a little part of all of us in many of them. And to love on these guys and to shepherd them and to mentor them is what society must do, because these guys are coming out. And how do they come out, and to where do they go, and to whom do they look for guidance and love in the end? And that's so much of what this is all really about, is love. And there's not enough of it out there for men, Wayne. And I think that's what leads to so many of these problems. I want to transition to another area and another one that's dear to our hearts. In fact, I just saw a movie called Man Down by Steve McAvity, the guy who brought us The Passion of the Christ. And it's about PTSD. It's about soldiers coming back home. Talk about the other passion in your life, which is veterans courts and some of the problems so many of our veterans are facing when they come home, Wayne.
Well, once I started with the prisoner and all the issues surrounding the criminal justice system, I also came in contact with a lot of veterans, and I put a program together out at a property that I own in Central California, where men and women who have fought for our freedom have a place to come hit the reset button. And I say the reset button because it really is a time where care and love and compassion need to be exercised. And as a result of doing that, I became more and more involved in veterans issues and listened to their stories. And realize that the kids, I call them kids now because I'm closing in on 60, that the amount of combat that they've seen is unprecedented, and the men and women who've done multiple tours are coming back, and they're coming back with issues that the rest of us have no idea what they're wrestling with. It harkens back to, going back to Vietnam, although people are not as hostile to the veteran today as they were, 35, 40 years ago when they were coming back from Southeast Asia. Anyway, I was approached by an assemblyman, Devin Mathis, and he had some legislation that he wanted to go ahead and put forward. But he wanted to be a private-public partnership, and it centered around veterans courts. And there was a number of veterans courts that were being exercised across the country, in New York, in Orange County, down here in south of Los Angeles, and they had great success. It's a peer-to-peer type of program, but the success rates were, unbelievable. The recidivism for the problems that led to run-ins with the law for those veterans that came back with issues, the recidivisms were just a fraction of what they were for the general population. And so we put this bill together, and we've been through a number of committees. In Sacramento, we've come out with 100% support on both sides of the aisle. It's interesting that the two areas that I have, been privileged to serve in, those issues around incarceration and then those issues around veterans, seem to be the issues of the day. And it's two of the issues where the two sides are wanting to go ahead and make a change. And so the ball's moving forward.
Yeah, what a wonderful thing in prison reform. My goodness, seeing Newt Gingrich and Van Jones walking hand in hand on an issue.
Yeah, that was something. I met Van Jones, and he was the boogeyman if you watch Fox News, and he was one of the nicest guys. And, of course, Newt Gingrich, I've known him for a long time, and I didn't know that they were friends. And they came together around the issues of incarceration, over-incarceration. I was active in Prop 47, which was a bill that went through the electorate here in California about a year and a half ago, And so, I got to meet a lot of these people and have, you know, detailed conversations with incarceration, over incarceration, and how we might be able to go ahead and right some wrongs.
Well, it's wonderful. Jeremy is on the line. Jeremy Thomas, a graduate of San Diego County's Veterans Treatment Court, who recently testified before the California legislature in support of AB 1672. And Jeremy is a Marine who was deployed to Afghanistan, a Purple Heart recipient. He's missing one hand after being injured with from an IED in August of 2011. And Jeremy, tell us about your story. You got a couple of minutes. We would love to know about the impact of these efforts on your life and how you're trying to affect other soldiers' lives coming back from war.
Absolutely. After my deployment, I was medevaced out, and there were a lot of problems with me physically, mentally, emotionally. During my recovery, I ended up falling into opiate addiction. That just kind of spiraled out of control there. And, before I knew it, I was sitting in handcuffs and, headed to jail. And, Veterans Court pulled me into their program directly out of county jail. And, it's just a life-saving program. I had originally gone in there, hoping to get out of jail and, get my record dismissed. But, it just such an amazing program. Today I'm healthy, I'm happy, and, I have a second chance at life. And, I strongly believe that, it's important for all veterans who, have sacrificed and, served our country that, if they need a second chance, that it'd be available for them.
No doubt. And I think you'd get the unanimity of people on every side of the political aisle, Christian, non-Christian. This is one of those things. And again, we wish the country would spend more times on the issues we agree on and less on those we disagree. I think a lot of it has to do with the media and a quest for ratings myself. That's half the reason we do that's half the reason we're doing this show is, you're not going to have many places that spend, we've spent about 20 hours on the prison issue, and we're just about digging into the VA issue. I have a nephew who's addicted to painkillers. The VA and the government have gotten him onto a SSDI. So now he's collecting a check for the rest of his life to not work. And we're worried about him, and we've put private help on him. And the only thing we know that's going to help is a program like this, peer-to-peer. But he's in the middle of rural Mississippi, and he's alone. And so many of these soldiers who it's hard to put a body on, I think, is what we worry about most. You want to become a substance abuse and peer counselor after attending college, Jeremy. That's really spectacular. Talk briefly about that, and then we want to just close out with Wayne.
Yeah, absolutely. Going through the program and getting help from psychologists and therapists and everything, I just became passionate about what they do. And, appreciating their help, I feel the best way for me to do that is to get in that field and, try and make a difference for the veterans and just people in general who struggle with similar things that, I've gone through in my life.
Well, God bless. And we know this, that no one understands what a soldier's gone through, particularly in that battlefield. I have so many relatives. I come from a state, my wife is a Mississippian, and so many people in the rural South serve. And it's in my family. Three people have served in my family, one in Afghanistan for over a decade. And it's rough, really rough. And what we're facing is rough. So thank you for what you do. And Wayne, just 30 seconds, just something to say to Jeremy as we close out this extraordinary hour.
Well, Jeremy and I sat side by side in Sacramento. I have a little bit more experience in public speaking than he did. He does, and he was fantastic. I think he was courageous, I think, going ahead and sharing your story, but also demonstrating that sometimes the way forward is to reach back and grab those that are needing what you have. And you know, we're not gonna get out of this as a country unless we start helping each other. Okay, the help is not coming from Washington. It's not necessarily gonna come from lawmakers. Okay, it's gonna come from people like Jeremy, or people that are working with me at Serving California, that understand that relationship and care. People don't, you know, the old adage, people don't care what you know until they know that you care. Okay, and caring costs something.
It does. It cares. It costs something, but what we gain is amazing. Wayne, thanks for joining us. Jeremy, thank you too. Be Wayne Hughes Jr., a life well lived on leadership. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And almost every day, not every day, but many days, we like to get the news of the day as seen by our Cracker Jack executive producer, Jesse Edwards. And today's through line, because he likes to run all the stories through a through line, is things that wash up on the beach.
A recent sweep of New Jersey beaches turned up unusual seashells and seaweed, but plenty of not-so-typical beach items popped up too, including a keg, birth control pills, and a rubber brain. Toilet bowls, rolls of toilet paper, a rug, a mattress, a vacuum cleaner, and a single-size 13 sneaker were also found on the beaches. Volunteers also picked up a half-torn dollar bill, a pacifier, and a pair of baby shoes. Also found was a stuffed goose, a pickled jar, an industrial fan, a sleeping bag stuffed with rags, and a vintage Coke bottle. Volunteers along the state's entire 127-mile coastline picked up more than 332,000 pieces of debris, from small bits of plastic to 46 whole tires. A retired police officer in the Canary Islands was surprised when he stumbled across a stash of weed worth nearly $130,000 on the beach. 58-year-old Richard Cresswell found the ganja washed up on the shore during vacation. In a bizarre twist, the retired cop took the stash back to his own hotel room and guarded it overnight, after a local police station said there was no one on duty to help him until the next morning. Not wanting to leave such a large quantity of pot with a civilian at the front desk, the next day Cresswell went to another police station more equipped to deal with the find, where he was questioned for over 4 hours before the weed was taken into evidence.
I want you to analyze. Look at it. Smell it. It's marijuana.
Listen,
you can see
listen.
That, Sarge.
You know we cannot trust our own instincts. Now, I want you to take this down to the analyzer and have it labbed.
Yes, sir.
I'll take care of it.
When the stash was weighed at a local fishing port, it was found to be a whopping 56 pounds. The investigation is still ongoing. A couple in the United Kingdom out for a stroll on a beach got more to show for their walk than a bit of exercise. They found a massive chunk of smelly whale vomit that could net them a nice chunk of cash. Gary and Angela Williams noticed a foul smell on Middleton Sands Beach in the UK. They traced the odor back to its source and came upon the unusual item. The reason whale vomit is worth anything at all, let alone able to fetch such a nice price, is that the fragrance industry prizes it for its ability to help scents like perfume hang around a little longer. The couple is currently negotiating with several interested parties over the lump, which weighs about 3.5 pounds. How much could they get for their odoriferous beach bile? A chunk of whale vomit about twice the size of the new find was valued at almost $170,000. The present chunk is thought to be worth in the neighborhood of 70 grand. Also called ambergris, whale vomit is manufactured in the digestive system of sperm whales.
I'm going to be sick!
Its texture is like candle wax, and when you touch it, you get foul-smelling wax sticking to your fingers. For Our American Stories, I'm Jesse Edwards.
I got the memo. Don't touch male. Is it male vomit?
Whale vomit.
Oh, whale vomit. Male whale vomit,
sperm
though.
Sperm whale vomit.
Sperm whale, but that's a male whale. Sperm whale, is that a male?
I think there are female sperm whales.
There are female sperm whales,
yeah.
Too? Okay.
I'm assuming.
It tells you what I know, huh? Keep your hands off the whale vomit. And now it's time for... Well, it's been a while, actually. How long has it been, guys, since Hengler gave us a rant? I think it's been
couple a couple of weeks, at least.
Couple of weeks.
He's probably pretty angry.
Oh,
can't
man. We better all step back.
He's been holding it back.
So today, it's the three things that churches must stop.
Stop doing. Yeah. The first one that they need to stop doing is telling their congregation to turn to the person next to them and to show them the sign of peace or to greet them.
Oh, it's the worst.
It's so wrong, and it goes against technically scripture, because in Romans 7, Paul talks about how the law is going to cause you, when you're told to do something, your body's going to say, no, I don't want to do it. For example, if somebody came up to me and I'm standing next to my wife and they said, hey, Greg, why don't you turn and kiss your wife or give her a hug? It'd be so creepy and weird that somebody's telling me to do something that's supposed to come out of natural, organic love. And as soon as you tell me I am supposed to do it, she's going to go, well, it's not going to mean anything to me because he just told you to do it. It's not coming from your heart. And we're supposed to be showing people love. And as soon as you tell us to do it, if they're a new person there, they're going to be like, that didn't mean anything to me. And it also checks off the list the person to organically come up to you and to greet you, especially if you're new. They're going to say, oh, I already took care of it when the person told me to do it. So guys, just stop doing it. It's not good for the church. Number two, stop passing around the plate. All right? It's only meant to do one thing. Let's keep this real, all right? Let's keep it real. What it's supposed to do is to shame people. No other reason. If you want to remind the congregation where to tithe, tell them the box is at the back of the church and they can drop it in it as they leave. If they forget, oh shucks, let them come back later and put it in the box. You don't need to shame people by passing it around, all right? Stop doing that. It's just meant to condemn people, and there's no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus, all right? The last one, this is meant specifically, those first two were for Protestant and Catholics, this last one specifically for the Protestants. Guys, quit with the whole worshiping where I can't hit the key. Yeah, band leader, I know you got a great voice and you want to rock out, but this isn't a concert. I'm not at a Rush concert here. Don't hit the notes. If you look around, I know you're really into yourselves, but if you look around the church and you see at least half of the congregation not singing, that means you're hitting a note that nobody else can hit. And are you there for yourself or are you there for the rest of the people to sing with you? Bring it down a couple notches so all of us can sing along. And every once in a while, stop singing and just let the congregation worship. All right? We don't really need to hear your voice 100% of the time. You're not that great.
I got to say, I'm with all three. Hangler, this is the first time. There is no...
Oh, come on.
No, there's no disagreement.
Yeah, probably your best.
Actually, that's going to be... He's going to rant against us for agreeing with him.
Even though you hated on my Catholics. Once again, you hate on me, but it's good.
I'm going to disagree with the fact that... How could you guys disagree with anything I say?
This is Lee Habib, Jesse's World, Hangler's Rants, and, well, that's just what you get here. More after these messages. And by the way, Our American Network is where you can go, OurAmericanNetwork.org, to hear all of what we do on Our American Stories. More after these messages.
Write a little song so you don't forget it. Sometimes I write a little song to remember the lyrics. I go 12. That's a code to my heart. I go 1, 6, 1, 2. Aquarian, for Taurus, a strike on the box.
Reluctantly crouched at the starting line. Engines pumping and thumping in time. The green light flashes, the flags go up. Churning and burning, they yearn for the cup. They deftly maneuver and muscle for rank. Fuel burning fast on an empty tank. Reckless and wild, they pour through the turns. Their prowess is potent and secretly stern. As they speed through the finish, the flags go down. The fans get up and they get out of town. The arena is empty, except for one man still driving and striving as fast as he can. The sun has gone down and the moon has come up. And long ago somebody left with the cup. But he's driving and striving and hugging the turns and thinking of someone for whom he still burns. He's going the distance. He's going for speed. She's all alone in a time of need.
Because this is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we love to do this day's in history. We love to celebrate the American dream anytime we can, especially the immigrant story. First generation, even second generation. People coming from other countries and just doing remarkable things here. And, well, there's one particular person we want to celebrate who's a legend in the automotive racing world. And I want to start by playing this introduction to the man, a film that Paul Newman narrated. Newman, the great actor who passed several years back and was a lover of all things auto racing himself. He had an auto racing crew and had fallen in love with the sport. And he did this documentary about this man's life we're about to celebrate. Let's take a listen.
He was hard on equipment and cars were tougher because of him. He was willful, proud. He carried himself like a gladiator. He was compressed energy, transfigured into speed. He was fierce. He gloried in the crowd. He sought fame. He was a flesh and blood man of mythical status. Mario, a racer. Perhaps the best this country has ever known.
Mario. That's all you have to say. And of course, we're talking about Mario Andretti, and what a life. Before we dig into that life, let's hear a little bit about what some of the greats thought about this man, one of America's great auto sports writers, Gordon Kirby.
Around the world, ask anybody, you know, who is the greatest American racing driver. I think 90%, literally, of the people around the world would say Mario Andretti.
And by the way, if you did this with a basketball player, a football player, a soccer player, you'd get a lot of different opinions. But in auto racing, you're not gonna. Actually, I think hockey, you're going to hear Wayne Gretzky. So I can't say. Hockey might be a little different, too. But hockey and auto racing and everything else, you're going to get a fight. You're just going to get a fight. And what about Al Unser Jr.?
Mario was one of those drivers. He was one of the bars that people would compare themselves to. I mean, for sure, when I started driving, you know, if I could keep up with Mario or if I could keep up with my dad, I'm doing good. And if I beat them, then I did great.
Well, that's quite a tribute. Al Unser Jr. and the Unser family, the other first family of American racing. And Formula One was only one form of racing that Mario Andretti dabbled in. He took seriously all racing and ended up wanting especially to win the Daytona 500, which he ended up doing. And there are just not many men who master both stock car racing and Formula One racing. And in fact, the two sort of look askance at each other. I think the stock car guys look at the Formula One guys and go, oh, that's a rich boy sport. It's so neat and polite. And I think the Formula One guys look at stock car racing and go, ugh, the barbarians. They're crazy. But let me tell you a bit about Mario Andretti. He was born in Montone, Italy in 1940. And over the course of his five-decade career, Andretti became one of the car racing's very best drivers. His resume includes three Driver of the Year awards, 67, 78, and 84. And he's the only driver ever to win the Daytona 500, Indy 500, and Formula One titles. Just crazy. So it was his life in Italy that actually turned a little bit south. It turns out, little something called World War II was happening at the time. Let's take a listen.
During the war, as a kid, what I remember is that there was a lot of confusion, like a lot of unrest, you know. How do you feel that as a kid when you see your parents, like your mother cries more than she should, or there's a lot of political arguments, like within the family, and you hear stories, horror stories about things that have happened?
And those political arguments centered around a man named Mussolini. And there were Italians who loved him, and there were Italians who hated him. And the ones who hated him ended up hating him ended up being right about what Mussolini had in store for the future and what fascism had in store for the future of Italy. But at the time, he looked like someone who could actually save Italy from some of its problems. And Aldo Andretti, Mario's twin brother, talked about how the war was tough. But after the war, what happened to this family was even tougher.
Their land was confiscated by the communism, by the Communist Party. As you might know, under the communist regime, You cannot own anything. I mean, everything is passed on to the state. Therefore, my dad wound up with nothing, you know, just the clothes on our back.
And that's because the part of Italy they'd grown up in was taken over by Yugoslavia. And Yugoslavia knocked on the door of the family's vineyard and said, that's not yours anymore. That's ours. And that was it. And so when we come back, we're going to dig into this life story. Because what happens next, you just can't believe. Generally, race car drivers come from wealthy families. That's the general impression, especially, you know, the Formula One racers, not always the stock car guys, but the kind of racing that Andretti cut his teeth on, well, that's generally for the rich. But this is not a family that started with a lot of money. Aldo, we're going to go back to one more clip from Aldo, and this is, again, Mario's twin brother. Talked about how the family was forced to move to a displaced persons camp temporarily in Buca, Italy. And that temporary situation ended up lasting 7 years.
5 years out of the 7 years, we lived in a room perhaps the size of three of these offices over here, seven families. Seven families, and we were only separated with army blankets.
And so imagine that, you know, you're living in a, and by the way, they described and showed pictures of this room in a different documentary that I had watched about the family. And I mean, it was like a 10 by 12 room. And years and years and years. And ultimately, a little seed of hope is planted because it turned out these boys were allowed to park some cars for a fancy hotel. And they would park the cars. They would start, well, driving the cars and sometimes taking them for a little spin. And one of the guys who was managing that hotel said, you know, maybe you boys would like to go see a race car driver and a real racing event. And so when we come back, you're going to hear from Mario Andretti. And the race car driver he saw, a man named Alberto Ascari, and an event he saw, and a sport he saw that seized him, seized his mind, and this became the passion of his life. There was, in the end, nothing else he could do with his life. We learned this about Margaret Thatcher. She didn't choose politics, as she said. Politics chose her. She couldn't get away from it. She had things to do in her life. And one of them, I think she thought, was save Great Britain from the clenches of the unions. And I think for young Mario Andretti, the clutches of communism and poverty were so much. And this was just a little ray of hope, this thing called race car driving. And again, when we come back, this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, the life of Mario Andretti. It started in Italy. But soon, the family would come to Pennsylvania, to a small town in Pennsylvania, and a career was launched. More after these messages. This day in history, Mario Andretti. This is Our American Stories.
Here in my car, I feel safest of all. I can lock all my doors, and it's the only way to live in cars. I can hardly resist. I can listen to you, and it keeps me stable for days in the past. Here in my car, where the image breaks down, would it visit me, please? I open my door in cars. Here in my car, I know I've started to think about leaving tonight alone. Nothing seems right in cars.
is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, the life of Mario Andretti. And when we left off, we learned that after getting through World War II, living through all the conflict that occurred in Italy, we were a part of the war. This was a difficult theater, especially southern Italy, Mussolini. And then entering displaced person camp because the family farm was stolen from them when Yugoslavia merged with that part of Italy and took over their farm. Mario says that despite the conditions, they found some hope in the form of an auto racing idol, Alberto Ascari, as I mentioned earlier. In 1954, they went to the Italian Grand Prix to see their idol, and it changed everything.
Probably the most important event as far as my formative years, as far as defining something for me. It's hard to explain. It's almost impossible for me to explain what I really was feeling in those days. I mean, I had such a draw to something like that. I mean, I don't think there was anything else in life that you could have presented to me in any possible way to say, this could be better. This is it. I mean, this gave me the definite, as Alberto Ascari, that's what gave me the definite direction, the focus. And I said, this guy, here again, you know, Ascari as a figure, represented, the true, you know, the hero, what someone that I admired so much. I mean, he had his heart hanging right out in front of him. And again, like I said, it goes back where how much even kids, you know, I was 14 years old, you could see this thing, you could see that effort. You know, on a part of Ascari. I said, oh man, there's a guy, there's a fighter, you know. And so that's the inspiration, you know, that it was so clear.
And that's what fueled young Mario. And it turns out his family, well, they needed to get out of Europe and out of Italy, and they had one place they could go. They had some family members in Pennsylvania, a small town called Nazareth. And they waited 3 years for a visa and finally got there. The boys, of course, wanted to just stay there. Who wants to move to a foreign land, learn a new language? But the family, the dad, knew what was best. And so they arrive, and Mario says that it was a strange new land, but they had some really good luck. It was a racetrack right near home.
What looked good about it was that it looked unsophisticated, so because of that, it looked very approachable. I said, you know what? You know, when we saw Monza, it looked like, okay, we were there, you know, but we were 20 million miles away from reality. Here, it looked like, you know what, we could pursue this.
And that was his point, you know, the world of Monza and Formula One, these were peasants. How were they ever going to get there? But this was a dirt track. And these were guys just rigging up their own cars and driving around in circles for prize money. They probably kicked in with a couple of local sponsors. And so what do? They build their first race car, the brothers, without, by the way, the dad's permission. The dad was frowned upon this. But the boys bought a 1948 Hudson Hornet. And in March 1959, the Andretti twins were ready to race. With only one helmet, one car, there had to be a coin toss. Aldo won it, and he became the driver. And because it was their very first race, he started last, 26th in a field of 26. And again, they raced without their father's consent. Indeed, their dad forbade it. Then came, after a victory or two, a tragic accident.
And all of a sudden, I look on the back straightaway coming out of turn two.
And I hit the fence, caught one of the wheels, and that thing flipped for a long time.
I mean, that car just went end over end.
It must have knocked me out very early because I don't remember anything. I remember just losing the car.
Immediately he was in a coma, and taken to the hospital. He was, he was given his last rites. I mean, he was breathing, but he was totally out. The next morning, the doctor said, we need the boy's parents here, or we'll call the police. So, you know, of course, you know, I had to face the music, and I felt like a criminal, you know, that for not telling them, and
But I had a sense of relief at the same time, too, you know, that, okay, now he knows, okay, you know, what can he do? Just beat me to death or something, you know?
What can my dad do? Just beat me to death. So Aldo's in a coma, but over time he comes to, and Aldo remembers waking up.
The only thing I remember is waking up in the room, you know, it was nice blue walls. It was a bright room, and look around, it was my dad was standing there. I said, where am I? I said, well, you're in the hospital. Poor guy, he had tears in his eyes. And Mario was there. I said, what happened? Oh, he said, Hatfield. Oh, man. I said, we're racing, you know. And it was at that point in time, see, I knew that my dad knew we were racing.
And the first words that he told me, that he spoke to me, he said, Marius, I'm sure glad you had to be the one to face the old man. He said those, and that was the best thing I could have ever heard at that, because then I knew he was thinking clearly.
So I figured, well, I'm glad that I'm in the hospital. You can't touch me.
And so, okay, we have Aldo back.
Imagine that. His brother's in a coma, comes to, and all he can say to his brother is, I'm so glad you're the one who's going to have to face Dad. And he said, that's when I knew my brother was okay, by the way. That sense of humor. And so Dad eventually accepts their careers, by the way, because they just keep doing it. And what are you going to do at a certain point if you're a dad? I mean, there is a living to be made in this, and it is dangerous, but the boys, as you'll learn later, we have some great clips about risk and how to deal with that risk and how so many American men and women do live lives with risk. And you can name them. People who work in construction sites, really high and tall ones, guys who work on oil rigs, soldiers, cops. That's just what they do. And I think risk is part of the reward, actually. It's a part of the equation. And you're never going to get risk out of life entirely. And some people just have a different risk calculus. Well, it turns out, ultimately, Aldo, I think, loses his will for racing after that. But Mario, it just fuels it. He just watched his brother go into a coma. And by the way, this is back in a day when racing was just dangerous. Mario, however, he had bigger ambitions.
Ultimately, he wanted to compete in USAC Champ Cars and the Indianapolis 500.
My objective was not for me to become Nazareth track champion and continue that. You know, yeah, as much as you wanted, I said, but this is, I call the stepping stone. I mean, from here, I want to go to the next. What I wanted to do, I get into midgets.
So, in 1961, Mario began to race midgets.
And so, he was working his way up the ranks. This is what he wanted to do. And this is much more expensive, racing midgets. But he lacked financing. And that's where his wife came in. His wife worked in a garment factory and helped support her husband. Here's Deanne Andretti talking about that.
It didn't really bother me because I always just gave him my check home anyways. So that's the way he used it. And the only thing that did bother me is when I did quit my job, I was 8.5 months pregnant, and he said, why did you quit? And I said, well, I was missing quite a bit of work now because I just was sick all the time. So that's that part I objected to. But then after that, then it's like, oh, we won't be able to get the engine done over this week.
And that's how they did it. They bootstrapped. Mario Andretti owes his life, his career, to his bride, Deanne. She wasn't thrilled, but what's a lady to do? What's a couple to do? This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. When we come back, the rest of this remarkable American life, the life of Mario Andretti, after this. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And let's face it, Mario and Aldo Andretti had the dirt track date themselves. It didn't end well for Aldo. He landed himself into a coma and ultimately left racing. But the older brother, well, on to bigger and better things. Ambitious, wanted to live the life, wanted the championships, wanted the fame, and just as competitive a human being as anyone had ever met. You'll hear that in some clips to come. At the time, racing was very dangerous. And here's Mario talking about life then.
64, 65, when in two accidents, I mean, I was in Reading, Pennsylvania, and it was Red Regal and Judd Larson, my very good friend, Judd Larson, who were killed in the same accident. We go to Ascot, and Dick Atkins, who was my teammate when I was driving for Wally Muskowski, he was killed along with Don Branson. Now they got two races. We lost four guys. I mean, that was just horrible. I mean, it's just unbelievable. But those were the reality of those days.
Those were the realities. And this is before a lot of the technology was in place that could really prevent loss. It's still a dangerous sport, but not like it was back then. His wife, my goodness, she had to watch all this. And by the way, as we learned before, she helped fund it. She was working at a garment factory to help get these cars built. Here's Deanne on how she coped.
Thank God I was young, because I think when you're younger, you don't have as many fears. But it was very difficult. I think a lot of the way to deal with it was not to become too friendly with people, because you never knew if they were going to be there after the race. And that was very hard. And every once in a while, you would let your guard down. And every once in a while, you did lose somebody. It was very, very difficult.
And we always like to bring in the wives when we can, because this is a family. Most of these businesses are family businesses, and the family business for the Andrettis was racing. The sons would go on to race as well. Well, Mario, well, from sprint and midget car races, he joined the United Racing Club in 1961, and 2 years later was racing with the American Race Drivers Club, racing midgets throughout the East in 1964, the same year he officially became an American citizen. Andretti became a member of the U.S. Auto Club and started competing in some of the country's best races. And just a year into his tenure with the club, Andretti raced in his first ever Indianapolis 500, taking third, which is crazy, and earning the Rookie of the Year title. The next several years would prove to be incredibly fruitful for the young drivers. But as all this fame came Mario's way, million-dollar racing contracts, commercials, well, Deanne felt like she was losing something.
The year he won Indianapolis then, in 69, that was a big eye-opener, because that's when I felt like, I don't know if I really do like this, because then I didn't have my husband anymore. Then he was public territory, and I did not appreciate that. I ended up learning to live with it, because that's part of the whole industry, any kind of sports industry. But I did have a problem with that.
Well, she did, and she had to learn to live with it, as she said. Mario went on to focus on Formula One racing, and then ultimately to NASCAR itself. And Paul Newman explained in this great documentary he put together that Mario was forced to learn how to race differently and to slide the car, which is something you don't shoot for in Formula One racing, for instance. Here's Mario talking about stock car racing.
It's not normally my style to drive loose or weird like that, but the car stuck. I had a feel for it, and I hardly had to turn left to go in a corner. I let the car just roll in and then correct. And had some guys follow me, spook. That's why I had to go for a lead by hook or crook. If there were three or four cars, I mean, that car, I was all over the place. So I had to just kind of dive and dive to the inside, and I mean, get the car to take a set. And I mean, just be decisive, go to the front. And I had to drive so aggressively. And you know, that part, I think, as I said, worried some guys, you know. Richard said, hey,
He said, we figured no way you're going to be there at the end. I said, well, that's fine. That's good. As long as I got your message.
Yep. And he sent a message, and everybody soon thereafter heard it because he ended up winning the Daytona 500 too. And then things went south a bit, and then they came back up again. He won, he started losing, and then he started winning again, and then ultimately, well, the career just started to fade. You can only do things like race cars at that level for so long. And one of the things that really hit Mario hard was the death of his hero in racing, but it didn't deter him.
You think in something like that, a negative like that would say, okay, well, you know what, we better just start changing our ideas, you know, maybe. No, if anything, it just, I think it created more of a challenge for some reason. There's an aura. Nobody wants to die, but there's a challenge there to defy that, perhaps. And I think that's the only way I can explain it, because I was never deterred by that.
And that was the death of that Italian race car hero that had drawn him into the game, into the sport. And so what were Mario Andretti's thoughts about the country that he came to, that adopted him, and then ultimately he became a part of, and a rich fabric and quilt that America is in the end, it's immigrant stories, and Mario's is one of the great ones. What were his thoughts about the country that adopted him?
For some reason, America sort of provided something of hope, if you will. We arrived there in the middle of the week in June, racing season full, you know, just fully on. And it was a Sunday evening. That's when the races were happening here at the local fairgrounds. And just where the house was, you know, you could clearly see the lights, and you hear this roar of engines. Alden and I look at each other, we just booked, and we started peeking in and see these brute old modified stock cars, you know, American style, on a half a mile dirt track, which was very typical. And the first thing that really came to us was, you know what, I think we could probably do this, you know. When we saw the Grand Prix in Monza, it seemed like so far away because, you know, the Grand Prix cars, the sophistication and all that. This looked like, you know what, we can start somewhere. Yeah. We can start there. So immediately there was a ray of hope. You know, maybe America was not so bad after all. You know, that's the way we thought. And our idea was to start saving enough to start building a car.
And so this is like 35 years after he came to the country, and he was being interviewed in a motorsports leadership series, and he was remembering with vivid detail the sound of the audiences, that little dirt track, and how in America everything seemed more possible. The gentry, the status involved in European Formula Racing's hierarchy, he just would have never gotten there. But in America, get the grease axe out, get the guys under the hood, give it a go, and these two immigrant brothers with nothing build this family empire. And we're going to close out with what Mario Andretti thought about risk, because boy, this is one risky business, and we love talking about risk and reward on this show, and I don't think anybody talks about it better than Mario Andretti in this clip.
I was never afraid of what I felt I had control of. And I always felt that, you know, I'm not going to make a mistake big enough to kill myself.
Right.
I had that feeling.
Right.
Or confidence. But I knew that it could be equipment failure, which I got injured from many, many times, and you're just a passenger, or somebody else's mistake. So that was forever present. But then again, it's risk-reward. Somewhere along the line, you know, you just you have to accept that. And this falls into the category of a calculated risk. Yes, there's a risk. Then I'm thinking, would I be doing it if it wasn't any risk involved?
Right.
Maybe not. Maybe I figure, you know what, I'd become a plumber or something. The risk is the challenge, mm-hmm. to try to have control of something. The race car is a beast, it can be a beast. Mm-hmm. Docile beast if you know how to tame it. Mm-hmm. It can be a terrible beast if it's out of control.
Right.
But the challenge is to have control. And it can hurt you, you know that. But again, the ultimate satisfaction is, you know, I can take this thing to the limit without it biting.
In 1994, after more than $11 million in winnings, Mario Andretti retired from IndyCar racing. In the ensuing years, he's been inducted into multiple halls of fame and was named Driver of the Century by the Associated Press. The life of Mario Andretti, a classic American dream story. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Story.
My new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88. Baby, we'll ride in style. Oh,